Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 23. It's June 1st, 2020. Chapter 1, Introduction. While it is true that many of the facts cited will be familiar, we are about to look at them in new ways. Clark Whistler. So it appears that topography, fauna, and flora form an environment complex, and as such, go far to determine the areas of culture diffusion. And though we once said that culture mocks at the bounds set up by politics, we may now add that it approaches geographical boundaries with its hat in its hand. Clark Whistler. They were not yet out of the woods. In the spring of 1857, they began their long last trek to a new and a different world. They turned their faces to the west, which they had for generations seen at sunset, through traceries of the twigs and leafage of the primal forests, and finally stepped out into the open, where God had cleared the fields and stood at last with the forest behind them. It was the end of Book One of our history, Herbert Quick. The Great Plains area, as the term will be used in this book, does not conform its boundaries to those commonly given by geographers and historians. The Great Plains comprise a much greater area than is usually designated, an area which may be best defined in terms of topography, vegetation, and rainfall. A plains environment, such as that found in the western United States, presents three distinguishing characteristics. One, it exhibits a comparatively level surface of great extent. Two, it is a treeless land, an unforested area. Three, it is a region where rainfall is insufficient for the ordinary intensive agriculture common to lands of a humid climate. The climate is subhuman. In the region west of the Mississippi River, the region under consideration here, these three characteristics of a plains environment are not coextensive or coterminal. The three are not found in conjunction, except in portion of what is commonly called the central Great Plains, that is, in the high plains, or the plains proper. In the high plains, the land is relatively level and unscored. It is barren of timber, and the climate is subhuman, semi-arid, or arid. The high plains constitute the heart of what may be called the Great Plains, and exemplify, to the highest degree, the features of a plain surface, a treeless region, and a subhuman one. The Great Plains area, or better, the plains environment, spreads out both to the east and to the west of the high plains, retaining in either case at least two of the three features of a plains environment. As judged by the historical and institutional development in the United States, the presence of any two of the three features gives the region the cultural character of the plains. Illinois, for example, is comparatively treeless and level, though it is neither arid nor semi-arid. It has much in common with Kansas and western Texas. New Mexico and Colorado are treeless and semi-arid, though they have by no means a plain surface. They have much in common with Kansas and western Texas, certainly more than they have with the mountainous portions of Pennsylvania and Tennessee. That is to say, the high plains, extending in a broad belt from Texas to Nebraska, are flanked on either side by marginal regions tied closely to the plains environment in a cultural way. To determine the true plains environment, it will be necessary to find the limits or extent of each of the three features named as fundamental. The level land surface. This feature of the plains environment, a plain land surface, extends eastward from the Mississippi River to the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. West of the Great River, the surface is plain, comparatively speaking, to the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, beyond which the mountains alternate with great valleys, plateaus, and basins interspersed with small, level plains. Topographically speaking, the Great Plains may be said to extend from mountain base to mountain base. The treeless region. This region lies almost wholly west of the Mississippi, crossing it only in the northern part to include Illinois and a part of Wisconsin. This timberline comes out of Canada near the eastern boundary of North Dakota, swings southeastward into Minnesota, and passes just south of St. Paul into Wisconsin. The line here approaches Lake Michigan north of Milwaukee, and follows the lakeshore to Chicago, and thence describes a semicircle to the southward, enclosing in a giant horseshoe of surrounding forests a part of Indiana and practically all of Illinois. It crosses to the west side of the Mississippi near Davenport, Iowa, and then turns southward across the Missouri near Omaha, Nebraska. The line then runs southward through eastern Kansas and eastern Oklahoma and enters Texas near Sherman. It cuts Texas on a north-south line about the center, passing near Waco, Austin, and San Antonio. From Austin, it swings eastward to the now extinct town of Indianola on the Gulf of Mexico. For the most part, the boundary between the timber and the prairie lies between the 94th and 98th meridians, though it swings farther eastward in Iowa and Illinois. The timberline boundary falls far short of, is far west of, the topographical boundary of the plains, which, as before indicated, follows the base of the Appalachian Mountains. But to the west of the high plains, another aspect of the case is presented. The treeless region extends beyond the topographical line along the base of the Rockies. In fact, it extends beyond or through the Rockies themselves to the Pacific slope. It is true that exceptions are found here, like oases in a desert. There are islands of timber, notably on the mountaintops in Colorado, Wyoming, and elsewhere. But when compared with the timberless area, these small forested areas are as insignificant as islands are in the expanse of the ocean surrounding them. It is only on the Pacific slope, in Washington, Oregon, and Northern California, that the forest covers any appreciable area in the West. Measured, therefore, by the criterion of the absence of timber, the plains environment would extend approximately from the 95th meridian to the Pacific slope. On the east, the exception is found in the extension of the treeless region into the natural timber belt of Iowa and Illinois. On the west, the exception is in the isolated forests on the mountain slopes. A simid or arid climate, the third characteristic, and in reality the most important one in determining a plains environment as exhibited in the United States, is a subhumid or semi-arid climate, that is, a climate deficient in rainfall. Again, the high plains may be taken as the point of departure. The rainfall ranges from 25 inches on the east downward to 15 inches on the west. The humid line, if that term may be used in the sense in which timberline was used, is not identical on the east with the timberline. It roughly parallels it, but for reasons that will be given later, it remains west of it. In the north, the humid line swings westward into the Dakotas, and the timberline goes the other way into Indiana. In the south, it approaches near to the timberline, but is never identical with it. As a result, there is a V-shaped region between the timberline and the humid line that is sufficiently well-watered for agricultural purposes, but treeless withal. This is the prairie region, sometimes called the prairie plains, in order to distinguish it from the plains proper. It is the best and most profitable agricultural region in the United States. To the west of the high plains, the subhumid or semi-arid region merges gradually into an arid one, where rainfall is below 10 inches. Again, as in the case of timber, there are exceptions, for in some mountain regions the rainfall is abundant, but at best, these areas are only wet islands produced by local causes. They are offset by true deserts, for in this region the clouds will not be robbed of more than a certain amount of moisture. If the rain falls on the windward side of the mountains, the leeward side must suffer all the more. The average is subhumid or semi-arid. This region stretches roughly from the 98th meridian to the 118th or 120th. It is now possible to determine, on the bases adopted, the area and the extent of what has been designated here as the plains environment. A plains environment is characterized by a plain or level surface, is treeless, and is subhumid. The high plains have all three characteristics. Eastward of the high plains, the limits of the plains environment are marked by the timberline, including a humid but treeless level surface called the prairie plains. West of the high plains, the surface is broken, no longer plain, but two other characteristics remain: absence of trees and semi-aridity. And these two characteristics are generally found in conjunction all the way to the Pacific slope. Thus, we find the high plains flanked on either hand by land belts exhibiting two of the three essential elements of a plains environment. The high plains in the center, the prairie plains on the east, and the arid mountainous section on the west constitute the great plains environment of the United States. The purpose of this book is to show how this area, with its three dominant characteristics, affected the various peoples, nations, as well as individuals who came to take and occupy it and was affected by them. For this land, with the unity given it by its three dominant characteristics, has, from the beginning, worked its inexorable effect upon nature's children. The historical truth that becomes apparent in the end is that the Great Plains have bent and molded Anglo-American life, have destroyed traditions, and have influenced institutions in a most singular manner. The Great Plains offered such a contrast to the region east of the 98th Meridian, the region with which American civilization had been familiar until about 1840, as to bring about a marked change in the ways of pioneering and living. For two centuries, American pioneers had been working out a technique for the utilization of the humid regions east of the Mississippi River. They had found solutions for their problems and were conquering the frontier at a steadily accelerating rate. Then, in the early 19th century, they crossed the Mississippi and came out on the Great Plains, an environment with which they had no experience. The result was a complete, though temporary, breakdown of the machinery and ways of pioneering. They began to make adjustments, and this book is the story of those adjustments. As one contrasts the civilization of the Great Plains with that of the Eastern Timberland, one sees what might be called an institutional fault, comparable to a geological fault, running from Middle Texas to Illinois or Dakota, roughly following the 98th meridian. At this fault, the ways of life and of living changed. Practically every institution that was carried across it was either broken and remade or else greatly altered. The ways of travel, the weapons, the method of tilling the soil, the plows and other agricultural implements, and even the laws themselves were modified. When people first crossed this line, they did not immediately realize the imperceptible change that had taken place in their environment. Nor, more is the tragedy, did they foresee the full consequences which that change was to bring to their own characters and in their modes of life. In the new region, level, timberless, and semi-arid, they were thrown by Mother Necessity into the clutch of new circumstances. Their plight has been stated in this way. East of the Mississippi, civilization stood on three legs: land, water, and timber. West of the Mississippi, not one, but two of these legs were withdrawn, water and timber, and civilization was left on one leg, land. It is small wonder that it toppled over in temporary failure. And that is the introduction to The Great Plains, written by Walter Prescott Webb, published, I believe, originally in 1931. I've mentioned Webb in passing as one of the three individuals on Philosopher's Rock, which sits in front of Barton Springs in Austin, and the book Three Friends, which features letters between him and his friends, J. Frank Dobie and Roy Bedichek, all three professors at the University of Texas at Austin. I wanted to introduce into the mix here a little bit of geography. I also like this introductory passage as it speaks to the importance of geography and how many features of human society are tributary to it. It also is congruent with Julian Simon's ideas mentioned in earlier episodes about how humans adapt and solve problems. Walking out into, or riding out into, the Great Plains from the eastern seaboard, everyone confronted new problems. And so I think we will be delving into more of this history, more regarding institutions. I also find it a little bit hopeful that these problems were solved, and that everything was shown to be changeable, including laws and weaponry and the institutions themselves. I like the line about that's a quote from some other writer. I don't know anything about those three folks quoted at the beginning, only that they're quoted here, but that culture can move right past politics, but approaches geography with its hat in its hand. Geography being this all around us and therefore very easy to miss, very easy to not consider. It was sort of a, not a throwaway line, but just a tiny little instance in the text here where Webb mentions that crossing from the eastern timber into the west, into the Great Plains, closed book one of American history. And that was, I think he said, in around 1840. And obviously book two was underway, and a whole bunch happened in the second half of that century. It would be interesting if Webb were still around what book he might think we're on now. And I think we're going through a period of serious technological change, accelerating in all these dimensions and social and cultural upheaval. So throwing geography a bit into the mix here will hopefully prove helpful over time to have the issue on the table and to talk about how geography and institutions feed off of each other, enable and constrain each other over time, and what people have done about it. I think that's a good close for today. I'm eager, I for the first time, started to think about what I might read next and following, and so there is a thread here, at least in my mind. And I've mentioned before, coming soon will be much better use of the web and media and simple tools to share that with y'all, keep things in context, and as a little kind of preview, also starting to schedule the first of the regular conversations, which I intend to release on weekends, nice in-depth interviews with interesting people about any number of these topics. Also, they're just their stories. Everybody's got a fascinating story and brings their own unique synthesis of skills and experiences, and I cannot wait to start throwing that into the mix. So I'm working on it, and hope to share that with you this month. Thanks, everybody. Have a good one.